Well, good morning. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for having me. For having me back. Coming to Portland every so often is a fun part of my life and my wife's life. Y'all are. It's a great community and a nice state and a fun group to be with. So today we're going to take a good while and talk about business succession planning, which is really just planning with an overlay of peculiar family dynamics, oftentimes. That's really, in my judgment, what you have. And there are lots of different ways to approach this topic and to approach the whole area, different slices that you can use. So I'm going to give you a couple of those, and then we'll come back to those as we kind of go through it. You'll see in the materials that I tend to break things down in the family business area to the leadership problem and the money problem, and we'll talk about those, and that's a slice. An entirely different slice is to remember that a family business can be divided up into maybe four things: vote, perks, equity, and cash flow. And that part of your job may be to see who should have the vote and the equity and the perks and the cash flow. And maybe it's different people, and you can move those things around. Then I think that the area is related to other areas, and that we can learn things, oddly enough, from public companies, and we can learn things from nonprofits. Because in my judgment, what I see with family businesses is that they have some elements of public companies, and they have some elements sometimes of nonprofits. So what can we learn from our observation and experiences there? So we'll try to put those together as we walk through. I am acutely conscious that almost all of you will leave this session dissatisfied. You won't be dissatisfied. You may be dissatisfied because of my accent. You can't really understand me. That's possible. But more likely, you'll be dissatisfied because a lot of what I'm going to tell you, you're going to say, is just common sense or obvious or whatever, because a lot of this is obvious. It's just interesting to think about other experiences and how you do it. The other piece is that a lot of what we do here is just other estate planning. So I'm going to talk about a grat in a business, and many of you know all about grats, and so you don't want to hear about grats, but I got to talk about it in a little bit more detail than I might ordinarily, because some of you don't. So it's different levels, et cetera. My wife always finds this kind of humorous, because she says, well, you'll teach a whole law school course on this topic, or you'll teach a week course, or sometimes, and say, well, it's different teaching an hour and a half. Sometimes it's easier to do a long session. So bear with me in those things. I read in Forbes magazine some facts, alleged facts, maybe they're facts, I don't know, Forbes thinks they're facts, of what they refer to as a silver tsunami. That their stats are that 15% of family businesses will be transitioned down to family. Well, okay, that doesn't shock us. Somebody told me it was 12% or 22%. I think we'd all kind of shrug and say, okay. But of the other 85%, Forbes thinks that only 20% will be sold as a business at all, and that the rest will simply be liquidated, will simply go out of business. And the activity that that family business was performing will be absorbed by other folks. If it's manufacturing, maybe it's people overseas, maybe it's other businesses out of town, whatever. So if you think about that, you say, well, it's an interesting notion. Not only are families having a hard time finding another generation to take over, but they're having a hard time finding anybody to take over, or they're not getting around to it, or something. There are barriers here. So part of our job, I suppose, is to say, what can we do to reduce those barriers? So, you'll see at the beginning of the materials, and I'm going to kind of walk through, I'll give you page numbers, but it's not key there. We're going to spend a lot of time on what I refer to as the money problem. So let's start at the leadership problem for just a minute. Finding competent people is not easy, right? You all hire people to work in your businesses, accounting firms, law firms, banks, trust companies. And my guess is that if you're like I am, some of the people turn out about how you expected. Some of them don't. Some you kind of hope will go one direction and some don't. But it's hard. Very few law firms can point and say, we've been around for 50 years or 100 years and we've never had a managing partner that we had to kind of ease out after a year or two because it just wasn't working. Most of the time, you end up with people who are problematic at some point or just can't grow into the job. There are obviously some positions in the world where it's notoriously impossible. NFL quarterbacks are the poster child for that. It is apparently just darn near impossible to determine in advance who's going to be a great or even pretty good NFL quarterback. I assume it's easier to determine all the people who would be terrible, right? I mean, you can look at me, terrible, going to be terrible. But who's going to be good is harder. Go back a ways. Roman emperors, terrible. The Roman Empire never had a good way to pick competent emperors. Now, happily, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have good communication, etc. So the emperor could kind of nuke stuff right near where the emperor was, but had a hard time affecting things a long way away, so everybody could bop along. Closer to home, you might not, but you might conclude that, gee, we don't have a perfect track record of picking competent presidents year after year. Whoever you like, whatever side, you're not going to think that we have a very good track record there. So why would it surprise your clients, the Smiths or the Joneses or whoever they are, that they are not going to be able to find somebody who can run their family business in the family year after year after year after year, generation after generation? What are the chances that somebody who has a great idea for a business and is able to execute that great idea and has the good fortune to have that execution prosper is then going to have another generation who can do the same and another generation after that? The odds aren't great. So all of that is one way to look at it, is to make you feel better. It's not your fault that you can't identify somebody to run the business in the next generation. That's not your fault. It's not the family's fault. What is a problem, of course, is to deny the obvious. I mean, it's perfectly fine, in my judgment, to lie to other people, but it's a problem to lie to yourself. That gets you into trouble. And if mom and dad won't tune up with, we don't have any children or grandchildren who can run this business, that's not a happy circumstance, it seems to me. And so to that degree, you can help. Well, how can you help? Well, of course, you can always get yourself fired. You can go in and make the obvious point. Are you kidding? Do you know anything about your daughter? That won't be a good result. But what you could do is you could say, in my experience, many businesses can ascertain the strengths and weaknesses of children or grandchildren by having them go work for others and see how they do. In my experience, many people in business kind of carve off a discrete, non-essential portion of a business and let a child or grandchild run it. Kind of back off and see how they do. They'll make some mistakes and you'll grit your teeth, but just let them see how they do. In other words, you can encourage people to let their descendants prove themselves. That would be the positive way to look at it. And if it turns out that they prove themselves to be incompetent, this is not your problem. And it's a good thing for the family, it seems to me, to know. Some families have rules about that. I represent a big family business that has a rule that everybody who comes to work in that business, who's a member of the family, has to have 2 degrees. Most of the time, that's an undergraduate degree and an MBA. Occasionally, it's a law degree. I keep waiting for them to say, no, it has to be a real degree. Can't be a law degree. But there have been others. There's a fellow who had a master's in, I don't know what it's called, but it's essentially a master's in filmmaking or something like that. But that's okay. It's a 2. It's a rule that you have to go through that. And it's a filter. It's a filter. And it also gives people who don't want to work in the business, but they've got this family pressure, well, they can kind of avoid working in the business. How? By just never getting around to getting that second degree. You know? And that's not hard to do. You can avoid getting a second degree if you want. So it gives everybody kind of a very graceful sort of deal. I've said at retirement dinners and overheard conversations, hey, why didn't you ever go work in the business? Well, it was funny. I always thought I would. But at this age, I got involved in doing so-and-so and such, and then I just never felt like I could go back to school. I got to be old, and so I just kind of did it, and that's what we did. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a nice story, and it works out pretty well. So there are things about that I think you and I can help with, can give some structure to the parents and the grandparents to see what they can do. The other piece about that, of course, is that you don't have to operate the business. Another slice of this is to remember that you can own a business and not operate it. In fact, I bet there are people in this room who own businesses but don't operate them. Anybody here own a share of a publicly traded company? Lots of people do, right? Lots of people kind of wish they didn't after this week, but lots of people do. Well, you own a business, a piece of a business. For most of us, not a very big piece of the businesses, but you don't operate the business. Well, that's an interesting family dynamic as well. Most families, if they go long enough and they spread out and you have enough descendants, most of the folks there are going to be owners. Well, what does it mean to own a business? What does it mean if a substantial part of your net worth is going to be in that business? It's an interesting thing. Imagine for just a moment that you were given a substantial part of your inheritance, your net worth is, in a particular public company. I don't care if it's Apple or if it's a utility, what it is. And you have some reason why you can't sell that, at least not right away. Maybe never, but at least not right away. Many of us have that because we have somehow or the other low basis in the company that Dad worked for instance, or that Grandpa worked for. We don't want to sell it yet for various reasons. But whatever, imagine you have that. You're going to have a different attitude toward that company than just the random 100 shares of IBM that happened to be in your portfolio next to the 100 shares of GE, next to the 100 shares of Apple. If you happen to know a whole bunch of other owners of that same stock, it would be different still. And you have the opportunity to say, I'm going to know more about this business, I'm going to care more about this business, and I'm going to try to really respect what happens in this business with respect to the leadership and the marketing, et cetera, because someday I may have to get out, but right now what I need to do is be a very conscientious owner and not just decide, do I get out or stay in? In other words, my 100 shares of IBM, if I don't like management of IBM, I could write management of IBM and say, I think you should do something else. That would be good. Maybe I'd get a coupon for a copier. But if I have a big family, not of IBM, but of a close deal, I can have more influence. I can try to direct that a little bit more. There is something to be learned there from a nonprofit experience. A lot of my clients, I bet a lot of your clients, spend a lot of time on nonprofits. Some of those clients treat a nonprofit like they treat a publicly traded stock in their portfolio. They got IBM, they're on the board of the Opera. If IBM's management doesn't do what they think it's going to do, then what it ought to do, if it's not going very well, boom, they fire it, they sell IBM. If they think the Opera is going off doing something crazy, they just bail on the board. But many of your clients have a real vested interest in the Opera, or the Red Cross, or the university, or the church, or the hospital. And if the management is off in Never Never Land, or the board isn't doing what it's supposed to do? They get in and they work on it, right? They get in and they help. They have they feel a responsibility to get this back on track. That's the equivalent, in my judgment, to the owner mentality, not the operator mentality, of a family business. If you think that's a helpful sort of analogy, think about that as you're trying to help families become owners. One of the things I spend a lot of time doing, whether I do it well or not, I don't know, but one of the things I spend a lot of time doing is talking to younger generations about business. I have a lot of families who's the relevant generation, people who are now 20, 18, 23. They are, they're humanities majors, let's call it, by which I mean they're not MBA people, they're not business people. And the business people in the business, often in the trust company that the family uses, are great once the people have a little tiny bit of background. But they aren't necessarily equipped to literally start from zero. How do we deal with somebody who's an art history major, knows nothing about business, get them a little bit, and now we can take over? Well, I'm kind of a handy person there because the first thing about business I ever knew was the day I started law school. I was a classics and history major. Never had an accounting class. I think I had like macroeconomics or something like that. Never did any of that. So I have a pretty good acquaintance with what's it like to not really know what a coupon on a bond is and have to learn. And how do you relate that to other kinds of things? I find two reactions most of the time when I start trying to explain business to people. One reaction is, oh my goodness, nobody knows why we are successful. Nobody knows why people buy our product versus another. Nobody knows why people hire us versus somebody else. Even if we could demonstrate that we're better, nobody knows we're better, and we don't have any real way to tell them. We need to sell this business because we don't know why it's any good. Then I have the other reaction, which is, well, this business kind of runs itself. I mean, people just come in and they buy our product, and they've always been buying our product. They use our service. They've always been using our service. And nobody really knows why, but it's just not that big a deal. You advertise and money comes in. Why do we pay these people who run the business so much money? Often I have the same reaction. I have both of those reactions from the same person. And that's kind of a thing. You sort of, huh, well, okay. Because as we know, the answer is somewhere in the middle. Business is not impossible, but it's not easy either. It requires a little bit of imagination. It requires a lot of attention to detail, but mostly it requires a whole group of people every day getting up and thinking about it and doing what they are supposed to do as part of the whole every single day. That's what it requires. I think that's one reason why a lot of people who have been involved in sports are very good in a lot of businesses, because a lot of sports coaches, a lot of sports teams, that's how they operate. You are an offensive tackle. Here is what you do. Don't worry about the defensive tackle. Don't worry about that. I got them covered. You, this is what you're supposed to do. When they get in to be a sales position, this is what you do. Don't worry about the shipping department. Or you're in the shipping department, don't worry about the salespeople. This is what you do. There's some degree of that, trying to impart that notion to a family member, a young family member, to say, this is how the business operates. And if you want to understand the business, you got to spend time. You've got to go to the salespeople and figure out what do they do. And what do they not do? Not in a pejorative way. Just figure it out. And then you got to go to the shipping people and the manufacturing side. You got to figure out what do these people do so you understand how the business is operating. The other thing that I tell them, this may or may not be useful to you, is that every day the board and the management of that business is making a mistake. Every day they make a decision that will turn out to be wrong. But they also make a bunch of decisions that will turn out to be right. They're making a bunch of decisions, and you can't worry about it. So I'll give you my favorite example. This is in Louisville, Kentucky. This is perfectly public. You may know the Tennessee sipping whiskey Jack Daniels. They know Jack Daniels. Your friends at Jack Daniels remind you to please drink responsibly, but that means a lot. Jack Daniels is actually owned by a public company in Louisville, Kentucky. That Jack Daniels as a brand, as a company, was acquired in 1956. If you look at the annual report for this company, in 1957, it says that we acquired Jack Daniels. It has a whole list of brands that it acquired in 1956, diversifying out of bourbon, not just being a bourbon company. It has a whole list of brands. You've never heard, unless you are a historian of the whiskey industry, of any of those other brands. But they bought them all. When they bought it, they didn't realize they were buying Jack Daniels, which has turned out to be one of the most valuable brands in the world. They just were trying to do something that might diversify. That is extremely explanatory to family members of any business in Louisville, because they all know what Jack Daniels has become. And their instinct is to say, some smart person in the 1950s suckered somebody in rural Tennessee and bought this company for nothing. And the answer is, no. They paid a bunch of money. The people who sold it were tickle pink. They didn't know it was going to become Jack Daniels. This is business. This is hard, but not impossible. So you think family members get a sense of this. Now, you'll say, well, okay, what's my takeaway from that? Well, the takeaway, it seems to me, is that you can help create a framework for family members to lift up and identify good leaders in the next generation. And you can tell them what those frameworks are and what you've seen be successful, etc. I personally, not speaking about you, I personally don't think I have any ability to identify successful future leaders in a family business. So I don't try. I don't give investment advice, and I don't try to give families, I'd pick so-and-so and not so-and-so. Just not my thing. Other people I know have a different view. But I have a pretty good sense of structure and how to move these things along. I also have a pretty good sense that if a family has identified people to do the next generation and they can all work together, etc., that if I want to, I can foul that up and make it impossible. I can't make people get along. No chance. But you know what I can do? I can make them hate one another. Absolutely. I can set it up so that one person in the business gets to fly around on the private plane and everybody else gets to take coach. I'd set that up. And after about 15 years of that, they'll hate one another and the business will be sold, and the primary reason the business will be sold is because we are tired of Uncle Ted flying around in a private plane. Guaranteed. I can do that. My job is not to do that. My job is to create a platform where everybody can avoid conflict, and the people who've risen up out of the family can try to get along. At least that's what I think my job is. So you will see, as you bop along here, a discussion of parties and things, nothing profound about that, except to ask you the question, do you know who you represent? I hate that question. I'm a normal estate planner. I like to represent everybody, right? I like to represent mom and dad. I like to represent the grandparents who aren't in the business anymore. I like to represent the kids. Sometimes the in-laws are actually kind of interesting. I like to represent them all. Other people have very different views. For example, there's a lawyer you may know, really great fella, great lawyer, Bruce Stone, down in Miami, Coral Gables, someplace or the other. Bruce will only represent one generation. If he represents the parents, he won't represent the children. If he represents the children, he won't represent the parents. Real estate down where he is too expensive for me to afford. Otherwise, I'd rent a little office right outside his office and just say, Bruce, I want everybody you turn away. This will be good. I understand the theory. You know, I got the theory. In Louisville, Kentucky, Tennessee, where I practice, it's not practical for me to just do that. At least I think it's not practical. Maybe the day I'm sued for malpractice in this bar, and I'll conclude it's more practical than I thought. But until then, I'm going to try to represent the group to the extent I can and to the extent everybody's objectives are kind of the same. But I do think that it's important to try to identify, and the legal ethics people say, well, Barry, you're off in outer space, you're making up your own rules, but to try to say, who's my primary client? By which I mean, if I am brought in, and I've been representing the parents for many years, I feel like I can say to the children, I can represent you as long as your interests are consistent with your parents. But there may be a day when either your parents or I or you decide you're not consistent, at which point you got to get your own lawyer. And then I will typically say, there are a lot of people who would say, because of that potential, that means we really do have a conflict today and you should get your own lawyer. I bet you aren't going to because you don't want to pay for it, etc. But there you go. That, in my practical world, works pretty well. I have some families where every generation has different counsel. I'll tell you one that is interesting. I've got a son who runs the company. He has a sister who doesn't work in the company. Sister has a couple of kids who do. He has a couple of kids who don't. Very handy. And they have had for a long time, predating me, her kids have their own lawyer who actually is in the process now of retiring, so they now have two lawyers. It is not the most efficient representation that we ever have because you just have a lot of, here's what we're really trying to do. And everybody has a lot of, here's what we're really trying to do in any given aspect of the transaction. But there, everybody has enough different interests that honestly, my primary client, son who runs the business, says, I'm happy, Barry, for everything you do to cost about 50% more than it really would, because you're having to explain it and then review it and then talk about it again with these other folks, because I don't have to worry that they think I'm running over them or not taking their views into consideration. Okay? I got that. It's just a cost of doing business. But honestly, that's an unusual sort of thing. What I urge you to do is figure out who you represent in this sort of thing. And I guess I also urge you to pay particular attention if a significant player is an in-law. We have another family that's primarily represented by another lawyer in our office, but who has a far-flung series of business ventures, all out in the state, in Kentucky, and there's nobody in his family line to run this, but he has a son-in-law that mostly he thinks is going to take over. Son-in-law either really doesn't want to take over or just likes to play hard to get because he's constantly needing more stuff in order to keep him in Kentucky taking over. But that's okay. I find it to be irritating, but I'm not in the family. What do I care? But I worry about that. Why do I worry about that? Well, because it doesn't take much for an in-law to become an outlaw, right? Not much for an in-law to become an outlaw. And when that happens, I instantly have a mess. I have been recapitalizing a company, and I've been passing it down. And who have I been talking about that with? Well, with my client. and with the guy who runs the things, the in-law, and with the other employees in the business, and now it all goes south. And what's the deal with these arrangements that are for estate planning, but that are helping the in-law, now outlaw, with his compensation? What's the deal there? And that's a problem. Should he have his own counsel? Well, he's not going to get his own counsel, I can just tell you. Probably your situations are about the same. Those worry me and present more problems. It's fair to say that I really just don't like in-laws. I hesitate to say that because my wife's parents are lovely people. Despite the fact that that my mother always referred to them as those people, which is not all that warm. My wife puts up with that because when my mother did that, she was in, really, truly, she was in the advanced stages of dementia. So my wife puts it down to her having dementia. My wife didn't know my mother when my mother was much younger. She would have realized that wasn't really the dementia talking. That was just kind of my mother. But in any event, in-laws are hard there. While I'm here, I'll get to this in a minute, but I don't want to forget this. Don't make any gifts of the family business to the in-laws. If you have to, keep it totally separate from the gifts to the family. At any given time, and this has been true for the last 10 or 15 years, at any given time, I am an expert witness in at least one, sometimes more than one, divorce case where the nub of the issue is a trust, usually a crummy trust, but not always, and gifts have been made to the family and to the in-laws, all in the same trust. And now they're getting divorced. And the question is, what rights do the in-laws have to the assets in this trust? Were they given proper notice? Was that a gift to the trust subject to the marital division? In other words, gifts are typically, they become separate property. So is that a separate property transaction? What is the deal there? Now, I'm an expert, not because I have anything fascinating to say about those issues. I'm an expert because the divorce lawyers never understand the estate planning. And they don't want to say, I don't understand the estate planning, because that's why the clients hired them. So they hire me as an expert to explain the estate planning to them, and they got to call me something, so they called me an expert. But it's a big problem. There's a very prominent law firm in Kentucky that loves that. They sell the idea, essentially, which is not bad. You go to Barry. Barry's going to tell you to make annual exclusion gifts to all the family members. But, hey, we'll tell you to make double because you make them to the in-laws as well. It's okay. But if you get divorced, you have a mess, and I just wouldn't do it. If you want to make gifts to the in-laws, give it to them outright, tie it up with a stock restriction agreement, but don't intertwine it with something else. All right, well, let's move along to our first, if you're following along, about pages 6 or 7 into it, we just talk about the simplest possible thing, which is the sale of the business, the sale of the business. And there are a couple of things to say about that. One is, and Brian will probably get into this when he talks, after a while today, about charitable things. There's a cottage industry in the world that comes from our friends, the corporate lawyers, which is basically that they're doing a deal. Business owner is selling a business, may or may not be an estate planning client of the firm. And it occurs to the business owner at some point that, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to pay tax. It's a miracle. And, of course, the business owner doesn't want to pay tax. And so it falls under the rubric of, I want to sell my business and pay no tax. To which my answer is, welcome to America. So does everybody else. Now, by that, what I mean is, I recommend, and I mean this absolutely seriously, I recommend that everybody who gives tax advice in your shop, every estate planner, whether you're in an accounting firm or a law firm or a bank trust firm, you develop a list of all the things you can do when you're selling your business to avoid paying tax, so that you have it, so that you can say when somebody says, hey, I've got so-and-so in my office, they're going to sell their business, the accountant just said there's this big tax bill, they want to know what they can do to avoid it, as opposed to just saying nothing they're going to want to do, which is almost certainly the answer. You can say, oh, well, there are lots of things. Let me hippity-hop up and spend 15 minutes running down the list, and you can see if there are any we ought to explore in more detail. And then you can tell them, well, you can get paid in kind with other assets as opposed to cash. You can sell to an ESOP and do various things. You've got your list. You can give it all to charity. Almost always, the client is going to say, well, I don't want to do any of that. It's like, well, you see, that's why you're going to pay tax. And it takes you 15 minutes. I kid you not. One of the other little jobs I have in my life is that I train development officers. And there are obviously a lot of charitable things you can do when you want to sell stuff and not pay any tax. But people fall into predictable patterns. You represent real estate developers. How many times in your life has a real estate developer come in and said, I'm kind of finished, you know, and I want estate planning. I'm going to start diversifying. I'm going to start selling. I'm going to liquidate this stuff, and I want to move in that direction, only to call you 6 months later, well, I found one more piece of property. That's the deal. So you could talk to people about, all right, look, here's what really these folks are going to do. You can give them the option, but give it to them quick because you bill by the hour. This is a rabbit hole. They're not going to pay you to spend 4 hours telling them all the stuff they're not going to do. They'll pay you for 15 minutes, maybe 20 if you have a nice smile, but that's about it. So I would recommend that. Personally, just figure that out so you know. What if the people want to actually sell their business? Now, this is an interesting thing, and I could deviate and talk about this for an hour, but I'm going to do it in just a couple of minutes. The problem is selling tax, and actually now we have a new era because that you know about, but at $11 million exemption, it's a whole new opportunity to sell your business and not pay tax, because all you have to do is have somebody die first owning a goodly chunk of your business. That's all you got to do. By which I mean, basis is the name of the game. Basis is the name of the game. I gave a talk in Philadelphia a month ago on this topic, business succession planning. And I started out, I was grumpy because I was sleepy, because the night before was the college football championship game, and I had to get up to get there. Anyway, I was kind of grumpy. I'm always in a good mood when I get here. But I was grumpy there. And so I started off by saying, why are you people here? You should be in your office making sure that every client you have is moving all their assets into trust and giving the oldest, sickest people they can find a general power of appointment. But you're here. There you are. So that's partly a joke, right? But only partly a joke. For businesses, it's a thing. So I'm going to give you two stories here. All real stories. In November, a lawyer out in Bug Tussle, that's somewhere out in the state. I'm not from Kentucky. I don't know where all these places are. I can find it on a Google map. A lawyer calls and says, I need you to come down and visit with a client who's got a bunch. So I go down. I spend a whole day with the client, drive him around. I'm looking at a whole bunch of property. He says he's got $50 million worth of rental real estate in this area. I don't know if it's worth $50 million, but as I say, I spent a day looking for it. He's got two kids. He's excited enough about getting the assets down to the two kids. This is all good. He's not totally normal. He's divorced, and he has a fiance. They've been together 17 years. Going to get married soon. I think that's kind of like regulations coming out from Treasury soon. It's an indefinite soon. So we drive around, but he points as we're driving around to a little house, a little tiny house. Mom lives there. This guy's about 60. Mom lives there, little house. Really? How's Mom doing? Well, she's doing pretty well. She's doing pretty well, doesn't drive anymore. I get her out for lunch, and my brother takes her out for lunch, and we take her to church. It's all good. Mom have any money? No, doesn't have any money. Are you ever going to qualify Mom for Medicaid or something? Oh, no, that'd be embarrassing. I just pay stuff for her. It's all good. I say, you know, such a deal I have for you. This is November. Such a deal I have for you. I can get you $5 million of basis on your properties in new depreciation. It was like being in one of those driver's ed classes where the person has, the instructor has one of those brakes. The guy just kind of stops. I nearly hit the windshield. He's really excited about this. Estate planning for the kids, yeah, that's good. It's all good. What base for me? Depreciation for me. Now, of course, it's $11 million there. How do we do that? Well, what we have to do is we have to take $11 million of his assets and stick them in a trust for Mom, and we give Mom what I refer to as a circumscribed, say that carefully, circumscribed general power of appointment. What does that mean? It means Mom can appoint the assets in the trust to the creditors of her estate with the consent of somebody else out there who is not a beneficiary and who's not going to consent if Mom wants to do something crazy. And the power only covers appreciated assets, and it's capped so that the maximum amount subject to Mom's power is an amount which, when added to her other assets, turns out to be $1,000 less than the applicable exclusion amount in her estate. What does all that mean? Well, what that means is that if she's got $500,000, I construct this power of appointment, and it's going to cover $10.7 million of assets. And as a practical matter, she can't do anything with the property. She can appoint it to the creditors of her estate, so she could manufacture creditors, but she's going to get the consent of somebody else to actually make that power effective. So, what does that mean? We're going to get new basis. Now, there are two aspects about that that you have to think about. Number one, remember I told you Mom is old, she's at home. She's not driving. She doesn't do anything that might generate a creditor claim. She doesn't serve on the board of any public companies. It's a miracle. She doesn't have a pool in the backyard. And mostly, she doesn't drive. If Mom is driving, that's an entirely different issue. I got a creditor issue that I have to deal with. Kentucky, which you don't care about, but Kentucky has really great law. It's ancient law, but it's great law that says that just because you have a power to appoint to the creditors of your estate in your will, your creditors can't get to that property if you don't exercise the power. If you're in Oregon or Washington or wherever else, you got to see what your state says, because those are real creditor rights that you have to confront. But I don't have that problem, and oftentimes you don't have the problem because, let's face it, there are not any real creditor issues that most elderly people have except driving. And that, of course, is really a products liability claim. I mean, the main problem with elderly people driving is the enormous attraction that drugstore plate glass has for elderly people. Well over 50% of the accidents in Kentucky, at least, dealing with elderly people are elderly people accidentally pulling into, kid you not, pulling into Walgreens. CVS seems fair. Walgreens plate glass windows. It's got to be something in the glass, I'm convinced. When they repeal the estate tax, I'm going to become a plaintiff's lawyer. That's going to be my first case. You can read about it. So you got that creditor issue. You might ask then the question of, well, okay, Barry, this is all fine and dandy, but how do we go from your guy having $50 million of rental real estate to mom having 11? How do we do that? And if you're interested in this topic more, I'm happy to send me a note and I'll send you a longer discussion. But let me tell you, because it's not very hard. I don't think it's very hard. Obviously, if your client has $10 million or is married and has $15 million, you might say, make it simple, buddy. Just give the property to the trust. And you say, oh, we can't do that. We make a gift. Remember, what do you care if you make a gift? If you are under the exemption enough, you don't care. Just be an American and make the gift. It takes a lot. You youngsters have a big advantage over old people like me because you don't have this paranoid fear of making a gift. So your job is to carry a sharp stick around and poke and say, don't care about the gift. Quit with worrying about the gift. Lots of clients. You may have all clients who have well in excess of $20, $25 million, but I have a few who kind of sneak into the office, pass the secretary, and they have less than that. And they can make a gift, and it's just not an issue. Just not an issue. But if they got more than that, like my guy out in Bug Tussle, what's he going to do? Well, let's suppose that he creates a trust. It's a grantor trust for income tax purposes. He's the trustee. You'll note immediately I'm not worried about estate tax. I'm not trying to get a dime out of his estate. I am trying to get basis. He takes $10 million, $11 million of property, and he sells it to the trust for a note. You are immediately going to say, that's an unfunded trust. You can't sell assets to an unfunded trust. That's a 2036 problem. Maybe it's a gift. There are all kinds of problems. Note to self, I don't care. All of that is true. This is not an estate planning device. This is an income tax plan. Client takes $10 million, $11 million, sells it to the trust, takes back a note. Mom guarantees the note. That turns out to be key. That's not a flourish. Mom guarantees the note. Mom has a circumscribed testamentary general power of appointment, just like I described. Okay? Mom dies. Everybody's sad, send flowers, it's all bad, sad. Mom had a full rich life. Not trying to tell you not to be sad when mom dies. I'm just trying to tell you after that you can be happy because you're going to get new basis. Because mom has her general power. The assets are included in her estate, and the fact that she guaranteed the note means that you don't net all that stuff out. You don't say, I had $11 million in the trust and $11 million note. That's zero included in my estate. You include them separately. I got $11 million. And I got an obligation. $11 million and an obligation. Now, if you're keeping score, the two don't really offset one another. In other words, it's mom guaranteed the debt, but that guarantee is not an $11 million charge because you've got an $11 million asset over here. So mom's estate is not zero, by which I mean Bill Gates can't take mom and sell $1 billion and take back a $1 billion note because there's a real risk that mom's estate is going to be worth the value of that real estate. That's a thing. So you got a cap there. You got a number there. But that's okay. My client is tickle pink about getting $11 million, $10 million of new basis. The fact that I can't get new basis on all his assets is not my fault. If he were part of the whole new generation artificial biology, he could have like three parents and he could get bases three times. Not my fault he's only got one parent. So I get bases there. What happens then? Well, that property gets paid back on the note. That's okay. It's a grantor trust. Still, right? Remember, it's a grantor trust. The fact that mom died with the general power doesn't affect the grantor trust status unless mom exercises the power, which she's not going to do. So I get the assets back. My client gets the assets back. There you are. Now, it's real estate, so it's not going to go up and down in value very much. If you're doing it with marketable securities or something outside the scope of this, then you might say, I've got to have some adjustments because the trust could have a note here and value here. But anyway, those are all things explained in a longer paper. The point about this is when you represent somebody who's got a family business, really when you represent anybody who comes in, a key question for you is, do you have living parents? Your spouse have living parents, got living grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins. Who you got? I've got a client who's a real estate developer who's got a bunch of his real estate in S-Corps. His accountant denies that that was his doing. I hadn't represented him long enough. He came to me with S-Corps 5, 6, 7 years ago. So there they are. He has Aunt Betty. Aunt Betty died, but he was the only nephew. Aunt Betty had a bunch of trusts. Call it three trusts, $1 million each. All going to come to him because he's the only survivor here. And he had a bunch of S-Corps. So what did we do? Well, we did what I just described on a couple of $1 million of S-Corps. And at the same time, we amended by going to court. This is Kentucky. That takes about an hour. We amended by going to court to give Aunt Betty a circumscribed general power over those three trusts. And there was all a formula that said, hey, then the max is $1,000 less than the actual applicable exclusion amount. Aunt Betty died, and he got new basis on these marketable securities. The investment people had bought stuff that went up. This is good. And he got $2 million in new basis on his S-Corp stock. All for free. He would say, well, it wasn't for free. I charged him. It was de minimis. It was de minimis. Just an easy sort of a deal. Remember, by the way, when you do those, particularly with marketable securities, remember, this is the coolest thing in the whole world. Remember, this power of appointment is just over appreciated assets. So you've got an investment manager who has bought stuff that goes up. You've got appreciation in the portfolio, but there's always something in the portfolio that's gone down. Well, the power of appointment doesn't touch that. So you will get out almost certainly a portfolio worth $3 million or five or two, whatever, that will have a basis higher than the actual fair market value. Because you will have gotten a basis step up and you'll have some stuff that already had a higher basis. Now, how cool is that? You're giving people losses. So those of you who are investment managers, you want to not just push high fee annuities. I know that's key. But you also want to push this because this will let you actually diversify and buy the high fee annuities. Right now, clients are trapped. They got a bunch of appreciation. They're not going to do anything. So this is a big deal in your marketable securities. But it's a huge deal in family businesses. And it's a super huge deal. Why is that? Because you don't know when people are going to die, and they don't die on schedule, and rich people take forever to die. There we are. Even Aunt Betty. Aunt Betty was on her deathbed, and the doctor said she's going to die this weekend. She lived for 4.5 more months. Didn't matter, except it was a miracle, and she lived for 4.5 more months. It takes a long time for people to die. So you have a client, they come in, they've got their business. From my point of view, even if it's a C-Corp, getting new basis is a no-brainer. We're never going to sell the business, ever going to sell. Can't imagine a circumstance in which you're going to sell the business. That's what the client says. You ever heard that? I've heard that. Maybe. New basis can't hurt. There's an opportunity cost. If the client has C-Corp, basis doesn't do them much good unless they sell. Also has a whole bunch of raw land that may be sold or developed. Well, I got one parent. I can do one thing, but I can't do both. Well, there's an opportunity cost there. I got to weigh that. But if all I've got is C-Corp, I'd take the new basis. And you got to do it, and you got to get it set up. This will not be in the law forever, right? Will not be in the law forever. Why not? Because it's insane. It is crazy. It is crazy for my wife and I to look at our investment portfolio. We're just lawyers here knocking around, saving a little money. We buy stuff. It kind of gradually goes up. And for us to get sad news that my wife's father has had a heart attack, and he's not going to die over this weekend, but he's going to die pretty soon. Heart failure is a bad sign. And us say, oh, no gift to us. We don't have $22 million. We're not going to have $22 million. Let's put $1 million in a trust for Ken. And when he dies, we'll get new basis. We can't get the assets back right away, but it could go to our kids, or it could kind of sit in a trust for a while. Eventually, we can get the assets back, and all we're going to get is free basis on our marketable securities. And we can do that today because there's just no consequence. No consequence at all. It's a bizarre sort of deal. In the terms of retail estate planning, I think you're about where you were in the late 1980s, early 1990s. In other words, when I started practicing law in 1986, everybody had an estate tax problem. That's not literally true, but almost everybody did. The exemption was $600,000. Everybody you met, toss in some life insurance, a little bit of inheritance, they were going to have this issue. Exemptions get to be big. Your class of potential clients goes down. It's now back. All the people you know have appreciated assets, and there's somebody in their family older than they are and who's likely to die quicker than they are, who doesn't have $11 million. The opportunity is to move it all there. That's the deal. The connected opportunity, by the way, for your planning is you're going to put assets in trust, and you're going to give everybody general powers, these circumscribed general powers, because you don't know who's going to die first. And whenever somebody dies, you're just going to get new basis. Crazy. A crazy way to run a country. Sometime, somebody, somewhere will have to fix that. During our careers, I don't know, they still let us get discounts on marketable securities partnerships. Go figure. So maybe they'll never fix it. But I would do it. And in the family business, if you start soon enough, what you will have is not just new depreciation in your S-corps and your partnerships and your LLCs, but you'll have basis in your C-corps so that you can do stuff that's kind of simple, like sell part of the business to the kids. That's not bad. Sell part of the business to people who are running the business. A plain, old-fashioned sale. Without much tax. That's not bad. That's not bad. Requires a little bit of time. You got to get ahead of the issue. You got to get your clients involved, but you can do it. At least it seems to me. All right, let me talk just a little bit more here about some other sorts of things that come up. You'll see in your materials all sorts of other potential sale items. I'm not going to talk about those. I do want to talk about, though, this retirement income issue, because this is a big deal. How are we going to keep money for mom and dad after they've sold the business? If they've sold the business to employees, sold the business to the kids, et cetera. And truthfully, I think One of the easiest methods is simply to have payment coming out of the business. Have the business create a retirement plan of some sort that it doesn't have to be vested because your people control the business, and you do that. And so it just pays. And when dad dies, it pays to mom. Or mom dies, it keeps paying to dad. And as long as the business can afford it, I think that's a pretty easy deal. It reduces the value of the business as you're pushing it down to the next generation, as long as it's legitimate employee compensation. If it's not legitimate employee compensation, well, that's a problem from the gift tax side, but it's fine from getting assets to mom and dad. The issue that you have is when mom and dad give up control, what if somebody changes the plan? What if somebody changes the plan? How do you deal with that? And there are lots of ways to deal with that. My favorite is, oddly, that you simply create an ownership interest that has nominal value, but that has to consent for there to be a change to this plan. So it's like a mini piece of voting stock. It can't do anything else, but it can vote on anything that changes the retirement payments going to mom and dad. You'd make it broader if the payments are really coming out of certain elements of the business or whatever. You can say, well, we got to vote on that, sale of that or some such, but it doesn't have to be that. But I would always leave it there. Some people will say, well, let's make it unanimous. We can only terminate this retirement provision with the unanimous consent of all shareholders, and we'll just leave mom and dad with 1%. Have a worry about that. And my worry is that somebody somewhere, either you because you'll forget, or somebody else because they won't think about it and won't know, will get rid of the 1%. We have lots of situations. People come in. They're old, going to die. You're looking at their assets. They have 1% of some business, and you say, let's get rid of that business. Then the issue of that company won't be on the estate tax return. And nobody's going to remember. Oh, no, they've got that 1%, so nobody can mess with their income. So I worry about that. So I'm much happier with some other little, very specially created. Doesn't work with an S-corp, because you can't have two classes of stock, but it works. It works with everything else. You'll see a bunch of other things in there, grats and such. Grats are fine. Problem with grats is they terminate, and then you're kind of in never-never land with your income. Private annuity. Let's talk for just a minute about private annuities. Private annuities are underused. And the reason private annuities are underused, I think, is because you have an income tax problem. If you do a private annuity to people, kids, whatever, you have a proposed regulation that says that is a taxable event. It's a sale. And you don't get annuity treatment. That proposed regulation can be ignored. It's not the law. It's a proposed regulation. Been around forever now. Never been finalized. You can ignore it. But if you ignore it, you got to file a special miracle form with your income tax return, which nobody's ever very happy doing. Your other solution is you can do a sale for a private annuity to a grantor trust. If you do that, you're doing an annuity with what's called a limited fund, and there you have something called the exhaustion test. What's the exhaustion test? Well, in a nutshell, it says, does the trust have enough money to make the annuity payments if the person lives to be 110 and the assets of the trust only earn the 75-20 rate, 2.6%. The answer is, almost every time, your trust will fail the exhaustion test. That's what happens. Can you skin the baby by... Skin the baby, is that right? Can you... Doesn't sound right, does it? Sound like that's kind of a bad thing. But why is skinning a cat any better, right? I mean, really? Different issue. All right. Can you solve your problem? That's a neutral way to say this. By doing a sale to the trust and having the kids guarantee it, can you get grantor trust treatment but not have the exhaustion test? People try that. It's a thing. I mean, you can do it, but it's not going to make you sleep well at night. You're not going to be thrilled with that, and that's why private annuities turn out to be a problem. The thing to remember is if you have good basis, you can do a private annuity to individuals, no exhaustion test, and you don't care about the tax treatment. So, mom dies, you've got these assets that have good basis, they come back to you, and you turn around and you sell them to your kids for a private annuity that guarantees your income, and then you can do your normal estate planning. That requires time. It's not a plan that you can say, hey, that's all we're going to do, because we don't know how long mom's going to live. We don't know, you know. But it's a strategy to remember because it works, and it's pretty good. Remember, on annuities, you can also do deferred annuities. So if you do a deferred annuity, it really jacks up the payments. Why is that? Well, because the payments in a private annuity are always calculated to be an amount taking into consideration the chances that you might die. So this deferral increases the chances that you might die. So by which I mean, let's suppose that I'm getting $1 million a year out of this business, and I want to sell $10 million to my kids, because that's the basis I've gotten when it came back from mom. I want to sell $10 million for my kids for $1 million a year private annuity, but the annuity numbers, because of my age, don't produce $1 million a year. Well, how do I solve that problem? Well, I defer the payments, probably for not very many years, and all of a sudden it'll turn out to be $1 million a year. And in the meantime, I do other transfers, other gifts that get the kids enough stock to actually produce $1 million a year. Does that make sense? It's just math. So you can do this deferral. By the way, if you start playing around with that, you will come up with a technique that is totally abusive, and you'll wonder why it doesn't work. And the answer is nobody knows why it doesn't work. It's just that everybody thinks, well, it can't possibly work. What is that technique? Well, I'll make it simple for you. I'm 56 years old. I'll be 57 April 27th. Let's suppose that I sell to my kids $5 million, and I say I want an annuity paid to me when I'm 105. I don't expect to live to be 105. Because constant consumption of Diet Coke is only guaranteed to help you live to 100. The last 5 years are on your own. What's the annuity when I'm 105? What do you think? It's about $17 billion. I expect my kids to be very successful. I'm dubious they're going to be able to make that payment. The section 7520 that does this say you have to figure out whether they can pay. It does not. Nowhere does it say in the private annuity world, if you're selling to people, they have to be able to pay. Doesn't say that. Common sense suggests that you can't do what I just suggested. But can I sell $10 million worth of stuff to people and they have to be able to pay $1 million? I think the answer is yes. If you go look at the cases, et cetera, nobody cares about that. It's in the range of possible payments. People have made $1 million payments a year. $17 billion payments, kind of skittish. But there's no hard and fast line there. Private annuities I like a lot because you can end up with basis. You can end up with actual basis. And it's just a pretty good deal. You'll see then, pages 15 to 20, the problem that you really wanted me to talk about today. I know this. And I would have talked about it first if I had a good answer. And that is, how do you equalize stuff? I've got the business. Whether mom and dad know what they're doing or not, we don't know. But they believe they have identified genius who can run the business. And they also have other children. We'll just refer to them as spendthrifts. Because those two tend to net, right? Genius and spendthrift. The smarter the one, the more spendthrift the others. It all nets out. All your kids collectively are kind of meh. But they get divided up. So, what do you do with this? How do you equalize there? And the answer is, you have no good way to do it. So don't keep hunting. There may be better or worse, but there's no good way to do it. There's no way to know what the business is really worth. There's no way to know how it's going to perform. There's no way to know how secure the other assets are. And there's no way to know what people's true preferences are. If you ask 100 people, 1,000 people, which would you rather have, $10 million of cash or a $10 million business? Some people will tell you, I want a $10 million business because I know a business like that's probably going to produce 8%. It's got a lot of other opportunities, and it can make charitable contributions that I can get my name on. It has employees that I can boss around, and I think I get to deduct my telephone bill. You know, I got all these things. And some people will say, cash works for me. I have an 80-year-old partner who says the people who want the business in that instance are morons. If you have cash, you can buy a business. If you have a business, you can't get cash. But let me tell you, there are a lot of people who want the business, right? I ask that when I teach. I ask the kids. Now, you know, this is a random sample of people who don't have any more sense than to go to law school. So it's not exactly a random sample, but it's divided. People have different views about that. And that's the problem that you have here. What you know and what you can say to the parents is, look, if you give the business to genius and it goes great, the other kids will always feel shafted. Even if the business was dying on the day you gave it to genius and they turned it around, you'll never persuade the other side of the family of that. If the business goes down, genius always left a promising career someplace else, doing something fun and interesting, to come back down here and keep the legacy going that, of course, couldn't be kept going because it was in the whatever industry it was. It turned out not to work. And I got shafted because my siblings got these other assets. There you are. Now, mom and dad probably don't care. Why not? They're dead. It's just a thing. Trying to keep the folks happy is a problem. You do the best you can. You get your appraisals. I tend to tell people this is odd. People don't like this. The people involved don't like it. But I say, why do you do it all at once? Let's suppose that you are a market genius. You're not a spendthrift. You're the genius in the family. And last Friday, you knew the market, the stock market, was overvalued. Smart. Good move. Would you have sold, would you have put everything on an exchange over the weekend that was open and just sold it all right then? Probably not. You would have said it's overvalued and I'm going to lighten up. I'm going to get out over a period of time. Why do people feel the need to sell their business today? Why don't they sell a little bit of it to the kids over time? Why don't they say, well, we're going to value the business every year for 5 years, and we're going to do our equalization there. How is our portfolio doing and our real estate doing that are going to go to the spendthrifts? How's the business doing that's going to go over here? Everybody screams about that. Genius, I'm running the business. I'm driving up the value. I'm not really getting the benefit. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's true, but maybe it's going to turn around, and you're going to want relief. This is our plan. you might try to urge people to move that direction. More often than not, I find that people want really to leave everybody in the business. And some people have voting control, and the other people still have interest in the business. Is that a good idea? Probably not. Probably not. You know, there's the old joke, if all my children are in the business, I have what? A soap opera. All my children equals a soap opera. But I have a lot of clients who want to do that. They say, I've got spendthrifts in the business, but you know, my grandchild is really sharp. I think they might want to run this business someday. And you say, what can that mean? You had a good time at their birthday party? They're 15. Who am I to argue with grandparent? Grandparent knows. I don't know. What do I know? Some grandchildren grow up to run businesses. There we go, right? So they leave it that way. We can learn something in that instance, in my view, from public companies. The problem with owning a minority interest in a business is you can't get out. And people hate not being able to get out. Look around. You've got a door over there. You've got two doors in the back. You've got these other little random doors over here. Who knows if they work? Set off alarms. Let's suppose that you just lock these doors. Let's suppose that CLE providers said, in order to get CLE credit, you have to be in a locked room for 90 minutes. Now, part of the problem would be the speaker. We got that. But you would hate that, wouldn't you? Even though most of you haven't budged, except for ever so often to kind of start and wake back up. You haven't really budged. But if you were locked in, you would hate it. That's what people hate about the business. They can't get out. They don't want to get out, but they hate getting out, not being able to get out. Public company market is a better deal. You got clients, they got shares in a public company. Have they ever sold them? No. Why haven't they ever sold them? They could sell them tomorrow. They can sell. They don't feel the urge to. So you can try to meld those two concepts. I like a lot a private company having a sinking fund, if it's a big enough company, doing an appraisal every year, trying to get everybody to buy in to this appraised value. If they sell stock to the employees, sell it at that appraised value. If somebody gets divorced, say, here's how we value the stock. This is our official family value for this stock. And we set aside X amount every year for people who want to buy, who want to get out. You need a boat? Ring us up. You can get money for a boat. You need to send the kids to college? You need whatever you need to do. You think management's incompetent? Probably right. Let us know. And you can turn that into a positive. Management benefits if every year the family is fully subscribing to people wanting to get out. We know that either we're doing a bad job or we're doing a poor job of communication. Something's going on here. If nobody is trying to get out, we know we're paying too much out of the company in dividends, and we need to retain more for the private plane, annoy these people more. It's an indicator. It tells you something that's going on, at least in my view. How much and how fast, that depends on the family circumstances. You can deal with that. But trying to mimic that, in my judgment, is a pretty good sort of plan. The last section of these materials, I don't want to spend too much time on because it deals a lot with charitable planning, and you're going to have a whole presentation in charitable planning. A goodly chunk, I suspect, will deal with illiquid assets, of which a closely held business is a part. But there are a couple of things that I think that really are worth noting. And those are that family businesses make pretty good charitable vehicles because they're easily discountable. What do I mean by that? Well, let's suppose that I own 1% of, that I own 100% of a $10 million business, and I give 1% to charity, and then the company buys the 1% back. They're going to buy it back at a discount. Everybody recognizes they're going to buy it back at a discount. When that happens, what has happened to the value of my interest in the business? I gave away 1%, and then I paid less than 1% to get it back. Now, what that means is that if I've given away a lot of my business over the years, grats, sales, crummy gifts, whatever, giving a lot of it away, I got some left. When I give that sum to charity and the business buys it back at a discount, the net effect of that is my family's wealth goes up. I got a $10 million business. Kids own 90% of it. I own 10%. I give it to charity. Is it worth $1 million? Nope. It's worth $600,000. Why is that? Well, because there's a 40% discount on a 10% interest in a C-Corp that goes to charity. Company buys it back for $600,000. The kids used to own 90% of a $10 million business. Now they own 100% of a business worth $9,400,000. Their assets went up. Nothing profound, nothing complicated about that. But there's nothing debatable about that. There's nothing arguable about that. The government is not going to come in and say you made an indirect gift to the kids. Number one, because the practicality of that is I get a bigger income tax deduction. If they say when you gave $1 million, 10% interest to charity, it wasn't worth $600,000, it was worth more than $600,000, they're not going to say that. The charity is doing everything at arm's length value independently. It's just the way the valuation rules work. Closely held business interests are very useful in that way. That's number one. Number two, charitable interests are very handy equalizers. We got the genius who's going to run the business, and we got the spendthrifts. The spendthrifts may turn out to be very charitable people. Very charitable people. Creating a charitable fund for them can be part of the equalization. You give them some real estate that the business leases to give them some income. You leave them with some stock that they can sell out of over time, but they get a little bit of the upside of the business. They're not left out in the cold. And you put some stock into a donor-advised fund that the company buys back for a note over a period of time. The kids who are not in the business get to control where that money goes. That's a pretty good deal. If you are a philanthropist, there are a lot of benefits that come from that. I mean, you got the warm glow and all that, but you also never buy lunch, right? There's a lot of positives that come from this. So for certain families, that can turn out, in my view, to be a real positive sort of notion. There are lots and lots and lots of other things that fall in there. We still see an enormous benefit to CLATs, charitable lead annuity trust with interest rate low. But there are other things. Charitable gift annuities as a way to replace mom and dad's income. You got this big plan, and I got a deal. I need to get mom and dad some more income. Mom and dad are charitable. Maybe I should give assets to a donor advised fund in exchange for a gift annuity. Mom and dad are going to get that money. Where is the charity going to get the money to pay that? The company is going to buy the stock back. Going to buy the stock back for payments that equal the gift annuity amount. And then when mom and dad finally die, maybe the company's plan is it'll make a balloon payment that'll give money into a fund for the benefit of the kids who are not in the business in the way I just described. So you can put all that together, and it's not a bad sort of notion. So I encourage you to give all of that some thought as you put things together. The fun part of transitioning businesses to the next generation is you've got lots of moving parts, and you've got lots of possible things you can do. The hard part, of course, is that people have to make choices. People hate to make choices. Lots of people have to be involved in the choice. That's a chore. It's all a thing. But it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of interest. If you're interested, as I say, in the other stuff that I talked that wasn't directly on topic, this basis piece, send me a note. I'll send you some materials. There's lots of other stuff in here, of course, that I didn't talk about. If you have questions about any of that, please feel free to send me a note. And again, as always, thanks for having me out. Thanks for your attention.